In every age, God raises people up to speak the truth to the world in a way that is currently relevant. Though our opinions should not be held with the same esteem as the biblical canon, we still carry the hope of Christ to the world. Our society has forgotten what it means to follow Christ. The bright lights of truth seekers are barely visible in the dim twilight of a post-Judeo-Christian society. We all see the darkness coming. All we can hope is to share the light that He has entrusted to us. This is Modern Apocrypha. Hey, I'm Jared.
And I'm Greg.
And this is Modern Apocrypha.
Welcome, everyone.
And we're... Well, to start with, I'm not feeling so good today, so I may end up like blowing my nose, or I'll try to shut off my mic, you know, but this is one of those days not feeling so great.
Sorry, but dear.
You'd been asking me about Bitcoin and what the deal is with the government sort of.
We've had a lot of changes in Bitcoin recently. It's something that I've become more involved with recently compared to anything I've done previously. And we've had the Bitcoin conference is what it's called, I believe, just the Bitcoin conference, which is where they have big updates annually about the thing. And we had some information from political figures in that. So I thought it'd be a great time for us to go back over kind of what it is.
Why it's important.
What its history is, what its kind of shifts over time have been. And then maybe if we can guess at where we're at now, that would be helpful.
Yeah. So first off, the Bitcoin conference, by those who are serious about Bitcoin for what it's supposed to be, for a monetary technology that is supposed to destroy the fiat monster, the Bitcoin conference is sort of a laughingstock for most of those people, because it highlights a lot of the really popular things, especially things among non-Bitcoin cryptocurrencies, what they call shit coins.
Okay.
So, and that's really held as being a pretty gross thing to do by most people who are serious about Bitcoin. They look at those things as being like nothing but scams. They hold things, anything from Ethereum to whatever the current meme coin is, serious Bitcoiners look at those as nothing but scams, and there's good reason for that.
It falls back into something like the same pitfalls of fiat currency, where you're giving up control of the quantity of denominations to a company that is able to shift it out.
Well, you're giving up control of the entire currency. So the whole point of Bitcoin, the thing that its success is based on, and the thing that I think will eventually lead to its failure, is the decentralization. And what that means is that control of the currency is held by parties that are hostile to each other to such a degree that nobody but an overwhelming majority of people who mostly disagree can change anything. So, for example, let's say a technology was discovered through quantum computing that could break the SHA-256 encryption algorithm that Bitcoin and a lot of national security stuff is based in. If that happened, then the Bitcoin community would overwhelmingly move to some other type of encryption. There are quantum proof encryption methods that are available, and Bitcoin could be changed in a substantial way to fix it. That would require a major change, but you could get most people on board if there was a clear and present threat, clear and present danger. Breaking changes, things that change stuff that are in a way that is not backward compatible, are really hard to do in Bitcoin, though, because the people who use it are so self-interested in making sure that nothing about the system is manipulable. So let's back up a little bit, though. The reason that Bitcoin is what it is that in software terms, it's actually a fairly simple system.
Okay.
the concept behind the system and how it works are simple enough that it's actually really hard to do something that would cause a bug or that could be hacked. Those are actually really hard things to do. And the update cycle on it is so slow and so meticulous that actually breaking things and making it difficult or is very difficult to do. Also, Bitcoin is actually a protocol. It's not a piece of software specifically. So let me tell you what that means. You know what TCP/IP is? Like the thing you use in your browser is HTTPS, right? You type that in front of any web address you go to. That's Hypertext Transfer Protocol. That means that I can look at the specs for that protocol and I can create a new piece of software from scratch that fulfills all of the functions the way they're laid out so that any web browser in existence can read the software without using anything off the shelf. Now, it would be pretty stupid to do that under most circumstances because that's all been done and you just want to use what's easy. But the point is it's a protocol, okay? It's a communication protocol. This is how you go about communicating this way. That's what Bitcoin is. The software that is Bitcoin is dominated by one implementation, which is Bitcoin Core. And they're pretty careful about how they do updates, but there are other implementations like Knots, and I was reading the names of two or three others the other day, where it's not all done through just one program. And what that means is that Bitcoin, even if one of those programs were to have a problem, even let's say Bitcoin Core had a serious problem, if the people who are maintaining the other programs are up on their business, they're competing with Bitcoin Core, they get bigger market share, and the ecosystem actually gets more robust because you're relying on more different companies to uphold the protocol. So long as the rules of the protocol are held to, everything works okay. That's what Bitcoin is at base, and the concept behind it is so simple that it's comparatively hard to break, so much so that people have put hundreds of thousands and even tens of millions now of dollars into trying to find a way to hack Bitcoin, and they come to the conclusion repeatedly that it's impossible to hack it. And these are people, so for our listeners, the thing you have to understand about this is that if you could hack Bitcoin, because it has a $1 trillion market cap now, it would be very much in your interest. You could make hundreds of billions of dollars if you could hack Bitcoin and you did it in the right way. Okay. And so everybody in the world has the incentive to do that and nobody can do it. Nobody has shown that they're able to. And so that means that what we have at base is a secure, decentralized currency that's online. It's not technically actually online. It is its own protocol, like most of the rest of the internet, sort of running parallel to the internet across different machines across the world. You can run Bitcoin through ham radios. I mean, seriously, it's that flexible. Now that isn't something people do very much because it's terribly inefficient, but the point is you can, and people have. And so the key thing to understand is that as a piece of software or as a protocol on the technology level, Bitcoin, as far as we know, is unbreakable. And if it were breakable, it would take something really serious that actually affects the security of the basic algorithms to cause the community to break the system in a way that is not backward compatible. With one minor bug fix, you can run the original Bitcoin software and it can still run on the network. Okay, there's one little bug fix where somebody did, the guy who originally created it did one weird thing. Okay, so that's all fine and good. That's a software level. Now let's move to sort of a monetary theory level. And this is where Bitcoin is actually interesting. And this is why other cryptocurrencies are not interesting. Okay.
But before we move on from that, we've established that the first thing about Bitcoin is it is very secure. So far as we can tell, it's unbreakable. And the other coins that are out there are just not in that same boat. They are breakable, or they are accessible, at least by the companies.
Okay, so the other coins that are out there, the code base is controlled by a small group of people. So even like Ethereum, it's a small group of developers that controls the code base. They decided they wanted to move from a proof of work system, which requires lots of graphics cards running at very, you know, very high power levels to maintain the system, to a proof of stake system. And they did it. That can't be done with Bitcoin because the group of people who are using it can't agree on that. There are too many people doing it. It has been tried a number of times, and it's just a total non-starter because the rules of the system are so robust, and people's desire for a decentralized currency is so strong that you can't do it. Not right now. Okay. So, and so every other cryptocurrency has a centralized group of controllers. There are a few others that are a little more decentralized, but they don't have enough traffic right now to really be effective currencies. Bitcoin has so much more percentage of the world's cryptocurrency traffic that it's the only viable system right now. There are others that are, I could name a few, that are technically decentralized, technically on the same sort of code level as Bitcoin, but they are used by so few people that actually crashing the system would be relatively simple compared to Bitcoin. It would be very hard at this point to crash Bitcoin because there's so much computing power going into securing the network.
Right. And what was the next topic you were on?
Next topic is monetary theory. Okay, so why does money matter? What does money have to have? We've talked about this before. I'm going to re-hit it really quick. Okay, so money has to be recognizable. It has to be something that people know when they encounter it. It has to be auditable, or it has to be, you know, there are a few ways to look at this depending on which currency you're going at. But the idea is you have to be able to say that, yes, I melted this gold down. It is now gold. I mean, I can tell you for sure it's gold. There's no, it's not a coating of gold over iron pyrite. It's not, you know, it is actually
the difference between money and assets with the description you've got going. You do have to have the recognizable, you have to have exchangeable, but worth and figuring out what it is, more asset based.
Well, okay. So as far as assets go, paintings can't be cut up into pieces and used as money, right? That's the major difference between money and other assets, is that the money is divisible, and it's, the word is escaping me right now, but the idea behind it is that it's fungible. You can take a piece of it and it exchanges for another piece at equal value. And it isn't like there's a difference between one piece and another piece. Okay. So that's the thing about money. And, you know, people have used seashells for money. People have used copper for money. People have used gold, silver, all sorts of things. What we use for money right now, the fiat monster, is a whole other subject. That's like four podcasts worth of exploration to just understand it, really. But at a base level, what you're looking at with any currency is it has to have a whole bunch of these different characteristics. There are like eight of them, and I can't name them off the top of my head right now, but there are like eight things that when you have those in some measure, they make money better at doing the job of money than other things. Okay. One of the things is scarcity, and that's a really important one. So for example, gold, on average, we can increase the gold supply globally by about 2% a year. We can't do much more than that. Because it is physically limited, it has value because it has some scarcity, and it's good at holding it's something that doesn't deteriorate over time. It's something that's recognizable. You can melt it down and certify that it's actually gold. It's got all of those things. Now, it's very expensive to guard. It's very expensive to transact with physical pieces of gold, especially in large transactions. And it's very difficult to transport. So those things make gold much harder to use as a currency than something like Bitcoin. So, but gold, those are gold's weak spots, right? In other areas where it's, you know, where the supply of gold being limited, while we have the ability to still mine it here on Earth, and we can't go take an asteroid and melt it down and whatever, you know, there are asteroids out there that supposedly have lots and lots of gold in them. And if we could melt those down, maybe we'd have a lot more, you know, total gold, and the value of it would go down, which may be why the streets in heaven will be paved with gold. You never know. But
never know.
Yeah.
Bless you. The
yeah. So anyway, the whole point here, what I'm getting at, is that Bitcoin has those aspects of what makes something money in a way that is almost scary. Okay. Gold previously was the best thing in history that we had as far as money goes. And it was pretty good. It was good enough that when we had a gold standard, it was enough to bring the prosperity of the world from pre-industrial age to full industrial age. And even the memory of the gold standard has been enough to carry us since then, because that's what really got us through most of the computing age too. Granted, we moved into some more energy-based stuff as well, but that's a little bit, I don't know, that's a little harder to dive into. Either way, though, point is, gold standard was really good. The thing that determines the value of a piece of money, though, is where Bitcoin is really going to break the world. And here's what I mean by that. If we can increase the supply of gold by 2% per year globally, that means that we have a 2% inflation rate built into the base money supply.
Why? Even, that would only be relative to a static population number, wouldn't it?
Okay, so 2% inflation of total currency in the supply is still 2% of inflation. Inflation is just the total increase in the money supply. That's all it means.
It's not supply-demand relative.
Okay, now that's actually what I was going to get into. So going there and answering that question, basically the problem is during the gold standard, we had deflation because there was an increase in the productivity of humans worldwide to a degree where the supply of all the things we wanted increased faster than the supply of gold. So the value of the gold that existed actually went up over time. Okay. So in essentially we had effective deflation, but the actual supply of gold was still increasing at about 2% a year. You with me?
Right. But if you had a difference of growth and you had, say, negative population growth over that same time period, where instead of going from post-World War II population to 14 billion, we went from post-World War II population to 1 million total people on the planet. There's a million people and a million pounds of gold. The gold stops having the meaning.
You're okay. Do those people have access to robots? Really what you're asking, the way we need to be looking at this is the total supply of gold that's available increases by about 2% a year. That's an inflation of the money supply, period, end dot. Okay. That doesn't matter. That's just describing how much money is out there. When you're talking about the value of the gold that's available, that's a different question. And the value of the gold that's available is based on the total productivity that's available, not exactly the number of people, though historically the amount of productivity that's available has been tied directly to people because we didn't have robots, right? So as we get more labor-saving technology, the number of people affects the value of the currency less and less. It's just the total amount out there is still increasing by that much per year. That's just a number that you have to understand, okay? But what we also need to understand is that during the gold standard, the value of that gold was increasing, even though the amount of gold in the system was increasing, because we were gaining in our productivity so quickly, right? Okay, so what happens when you have a currency that has a 0% inflation rate? How fast does the value of that currency increase? If you got a 2% inflation rate, over a 100-year period, you're still talking about the value of that thing reducing by a tremendous amount, because the total amount in circulation has doubled or tripled or quintupled or whatever it is. I could do the math. I don't actually remember. I knew at one point.
I do understand the math of it, but short of a military intervention, I don't see how you get people to use Bitcoin in a place where, I don't know, my seashell gets me a loaf of bread, period.
Here's the answer. This is why Bitcoin is so scary, is because if one person who's doing business with another person, well, let's bring in five people. Let's say person one and person two are using Bitcoin. They're using a currency that is going to keep going up in value because we're not creating more of it. Because the supply is absolutely fixed, it's not going up in value, or it's not going up in quantity. Its value is going up compared to the total amount of stuff available because its supply is fixed, right? So those three other people who are still doing business with these first two are at a huge disadvantage. They're using money that's going down in value very rapidly.
Well, no. I think in that case, nobody's going to use money. It's I'm going to keep land. I'm going to keep cattle. I'm going to keep...
This is not a realistic look at human societies. Human societies always find money. Period. Right. We just do.
Short-term need. Money for the short-term need of exchange, but... not money
right,
for a bunch of assets.
It doesn't matter, man. The point is, if these two people are using Bitcoin and these three are using U.S. dollars and the value of the U.S. dollar drops by 50% over a period of 5-10 years, which it has, then what you end up with is the first two people have a huge economic advantage over the other three. So it is incredibly in those three's interests to start using Bitcoin, if they can.
If they have the opportunity to, but if it's at a fixed number of Bitcoin, then how do you get a hold of them? And at some point, Bitcoin is electricity-based, and you just say you can't make electricity without something other than Bitcoin. Like, you can't have gas without dollars, that kind of thing.
That doesn't seem to be a sensible way of looking at it, and here's why. If there's less gold in the world than it takes to fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool, roughly. Total gold ever mined in human history is less than it takes to fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Could you own gold? Yeah, you could. You could go buy gold right now. I don't remember what the ounce price is, but, you know, it's... the price per ounce is such that you could go buy a few ounces of gold. If you had a few $1,000, you could buy some gold. Sure. We can all do it. So the key is that the less of something that's available, yeah, you have periods where smaller groups of people will monopolize as much of it as they can. That's true. That there's no question. But the remainder, what's still available, is still in demand for the people who have it. And some amount is always changing hands. So here's the other thing. There are only 21 million Bitcoin, but Bitcoin isn't really a good measuring stick because each Bitcoin is made up of 100 million sats, satoshis. So are quadrillions of these sats floating around, and sats are worth less than a cent right now. So let's say the value of this thing goes up 1,000 times. Your sats might be worth $1, but you've still got sats floating around that people can own and use for transactions and things. And there's no reason you couldn't subdivide it further if you want to. It's actually really easy to do. So it's a question of, if there's just this much unobtainium in the world, and unobtainium is the perfect currency, are people going to use it to trade with other people? And will those people still buy it? Will the other people still buy it if it's hard to get a hold of? Absolutely. That makes it more desirable. So the scenario of people monopolizing it isn't a realistic one in a human society. People can imagine theoretical situations where that's possible, but they're not real.
Why? You look at the Second Temple period and the alteration of the gold markets for years around the destruction of the Second Temple, and you know that the concentrations of wealth are a fact.
Sure, you get concentrations, but that isn't a 100% concentration. That's the point.
It is whenever they get to a point where they will not give you a Bitcoin paycheck or allow you to have access to it from the Bangladeshi, use Bangladeshi coins. And then maybe if they're lucky once in a lifetime, they can have Ashitoshi.
No, this is a silly scenario. And the reason for that is that if it's all about supply and demand. It's all about if there are Satoshis, there's a percentage of them that are going to be on the market, right? Maybe it's only 2%. Let's take it down to 2% of the total that are available, and people are sitting on the rest, equivalent of holding money in their mattress. Okay. Right. Even those 2% will become more valuable because there are fewer people trading them. Yes, you can get huge dislocations when the gold that's available goes out into circulation, like in the Second Temple period, like you say, you can get huge dislocations. That's a problem with a very fixed supply currency. We know that. But that didn't reduce people's desire to own gold. It just meant that the amount of gold you had to have to get goods and services was more, because there was more around and on the market.
I think that it leads to something like Mongol hordes, where they say, I'm not part of your system, I'm coming to crush your system underfoot.
Well, and you can think what you want as far as that goes, but the reality of history was that in the gold standard, we had the system working in a particular way, and a Bitcoin standard, as near as we can tell, would work similarly. The one big difference is that the value of the currency goes up even faster as our total amount of labor and ability to produce things goes up as well, okay? So history says that, yes, you get bad side effects from systems that have hard currencies. We know that there are bad side effects. I'm not going to argue that point. You're just right on that, right? But the idea that the system is somehow self-destructive, or that there's a way to monopolize it, just isn't real as far as we can tell.
Okay, I don't think monopolization is exactly the right term of how successful people are successful over generations per se. It's the break, and I think this is probably a bigger discussion than before the break, but maybe after the break we can touch on it, that
yeah.
The advice to forgive debts after 7 years or whatever it may be, it doesn't flow in this static currency in quite the same. The static currency, it seems like it's got a strange pairing with debts.
Well, okay, so there are people who think that, but again, we have actual data to speak to this. Go back to the gold standard. What actually happened during the gold standard? Because we can see what happened when you had a hard currency that people were using, and what debts did and how it all worked.
What would you say was the pros and cons of the gold standard? Because I can think of what I would describe as cons.
Sure, I can think of cons as well. How do I put this? Well, okay, so some of the pros were that governments cannot just monopolize the quote money and make more for their own use whenever they wish, because money is a confidence game at base. That's all it is. It's people have confidence in the currency, and so they use it to transact with, and that's kind of the story. But when it comes to the cons, you know, I can think of some, like the whole fact that you can get mugged and your gold can be taken away. They can invade your house and steal your property. I mean, that was a problem with the gold standard. It's different under Bitcoin.
Do you find it correlated that something like a gold standard allows for excess acquisition of wealth to a single party that would end up in something like the robber barons, right? The robber barons.
It's actually the other way around.
Okay.
Fiat systems tend to do that more than hard currency ones.
I see.
We're basically at a break. Let's take a break and then come back.
Okay.
We'll be back in a minute.
Back in a minute, right?
As you can probably tell from the backdrop, there are new things happening here. This is my new sound studio for recording audiobooks. It's not quite done, but it's done enough that I can record an ad in it, and that's exciting. I also have an anthology that I'm just finishing now. It should be coming out real soon. I have book two in the Bright Star series is basically finished, other than some professional edits and the publishing, and I'm pushing on that pretty hard. I'm hoping that there will be news on that one in the near future. When it comes to audiobooks, I'm planning on recording both the anthology and Bright Star. And folks, I need support and help now more than ever. Bright Star is doing just fine. I'm perfectly happy with it, and I am expanding both my ground game and my marketing game, and things are just growing. But the best recommendation is a recommendation from a friend. So if you like what you see on Modern Apocrypha, take this as a recommendation to you. Bright Star is worth your time. And if you've read it and you like it, recommend it to somebody. Help me out getting the word out about this series. And be on the lookout. More's coming soon. Energemetra6.com, E6universe.com, promo code Israel, 10% off.
Hello, Modern Apocrypha listeners. I'd like to take a moment to lift up North Arrow Coffee. If you're like me, you enjoy quite a bit of coffee, and North Arrow has a lot of really good coffees. But they're also following their very own North Star to support pro-life organizations. At North Arrow, 15% of all sales go towards life, not just for a limited time, but for a reason. So, if you'd like to support the podcast, you can use the code E6 at the North Arrow web store and save 10% today. Thank you.
And we're back.
Welcome back, everyone.
So we were talking about Bitcoin and hard currency versus soft currency. And I think, to me, the critical thing here that people need to understand is that in what inflation is and how it works is actually pretty critical. Inflation basically just means an increase in the total money supply. If the money supply increases faster than the total labor and goods creation and value that's available, then you see an increase in the price of things. So you're getting more money compared to the total value that you can buy with the money, right?
I'm curious about that definition, just as the inflation being defined as the number of currency units in circulation, as opposed to the quality of, like,
high. What is quality of value, currency?
Value of.
Well, okay. That's the point I'm making. Value is sort of an insubstantial pie of all the goods and services that are available in the world. That's all the value that exists. The amount of money that can be used to buy that pie is the total value of the money. When you double the amount of money that's out there very rapidly, and the amount of goods and services that are available don't double at the same rate, then you can buy less goods and services with the same money. If your goods and services expand faster than the money supply expands, then you have deflation, and the amount of, you know, the value of the money increases. That's a very simple sort of description of economic forces. And you really don't need more than that. You don't need a degree in economics to get that.
Okay. I'm fair enough to leave it at that. What I'm hearing to my ear, if I were to repeat it to you, is on the one side, you've got inflation as a flat number of currency units in play, and deflation is somehow different in the value.
Okay, inflation is when the currency units increase compared to the value that's available, right? So when gold increases, you can say you have a 2% inflation rate in the gold. The reason that they aim for 2% inflation at the Fed is because they're just trying to match the gold. That's all there is. Fair. The idea is just that inflation under the gold standard was about 2% a year, because that's about how much they were able to mine of gold a year. It's a 2% increase in the amount of currency available to buy goods and services with, total. Under fiat, we don't have a way to track it. U.S. dollar, we just have no way to know how much it's increasing or how much is available. There's no measurement for it. Hmm?
There's an intrinsic difference to understand with gold, silver, diamonds, etc., as opposed to dollars, in that there's a universal physical thing, a universal money versus a local decided money. A dollar may not be spendable.
That's what fiat. That's what the word fiat means. It means by decree. Mm.
So, and not everyone would accept a decree. However, gold, theoretically, Bitcoin, shells at a time, right? Whatever the item is.
They're limited by the physical amount of thing that you can get. And that's an incredibly important thing. And that's true of Bitcoin for as long as the currency is decentralized and you can't get one power block controlling it. Okay.
And something we were talking about on the break there was the change in the world with the idea of something other than the dollar, right? The idea of a decentralized, non-country-based currency and what that might change in the dynamic of people. I mean, just how they act, how they do the things that they do. The non-movable way of gold, right? The way that gold was static and it's essentially how much you had available at any given time. I feel like provided the means for something like the original billionaires, the first robber barons, right?
Okay, so what happened there was that a small group of people was able to increase the total available value in the labor force dramatically by themselves. It had nothing to do with the currency or the mechanics of the currency. It was specifically that what Rockefeller did and Carnegie did and some of the others did actually created such a balloon in value that was centered on those people, on those individuals, that they actually created so much value that it created this robber baron status for them. They created that much value by themselves. And it's much harder to do that now because we have a much wider field of values. It isn't that it had nothing to do with the rules of the currency.
I feel like that might be missing something about human nature. I don't feel like monopoly has ever been something that we haven't had to fight against. Monopoly has always been
But it doesn't have anything to do with the rules of the currency. The mechanics, the way the currency works, has nothing to do with whether someone can hold a monopoly. That isn't. They're unrelated things. That's the point I'm making. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm saying, we have that tendency as humans to do those things, but the way currency rules work doesn't change it. It one way or the other, they're still the same. What the currency rules do change, and what I was actually going to get into here, was the Cantillon effect. Do you know what that is?
What is the Cantillon effect for everyone listening?
Yes. The Cantillon effect is the idea that when you are printing money in a currency, when you're creating more, the people who are closest to the money creation have a disproportionate privilege to use the money, and the money concentrates disproportionately among those who are closest to the money printer in terms of influence. So we've seen the number of ultra-rich people in the U.S. and their net worth go up dramatically compared to the average Joe over the past 20, 30 years. The reason for that is the money printers. It is the Cantillon effect. That's what we're looking at. And the Cantillon effect creates that, where hard currencies actually do the opposite of that. The gold standard actually made it so that there were fewer people holding the money. It spread it out more widely across the population than any other standard we've ever found in the longer term. The robber baron thing you were talking about happened around the same time, but if you look at the standard of living of the average person, it went up dramatically during that period. The average person had dramatically more value compared to their parents of the pie than under any other system of currency. That is the effect of hard currency. And that's why average people love Bitcoin right now, is because if you get an absolutely hard currency that you're saving in, it will tend to make it so that you can't twist the rules of the game so that a certain set of people are favored, which is a big part of the problem we have in our society.
But do you not, and this goes back to the original, take any man-made system out of it, and even just over time taking people doing the best thing they can, saving really hard, whatever it may be, so that in six generations, I don't care how long your time frame is, but eventually you end up in a caste system where your parents saved and someone else's parents didn't. You've just been born. It's not your fault.
That doesn't tend to be how human psychology works. It's actually about two generations rags to riches and two generations riches to rags. So what we see in history, what actually tends to happen is the average Joe, who's a good man, works to build up his wealth over the course of two or three generations. He amasses a fortune. Then his kids tend to be less charactered people, and over two generations, they lose it and they're poor again. Well, that's the average cycle of the general population over a long period of time.
Except for that discounts all of history that would say that unproductive royalty stays royalty for 1,000 years. I mean.
Well, okay, so we're talking about two different things here. We're talking about economic system versus political power systems. And the economic system, that's just how people tend to be. The political power system tends to be a little different. And the fact that we have spiritual beings who've got their fingers in that mess complicate the hell out of it.
It does make it incredibly complicated, but I would argue the norm
has nothing to do with the currency, though. That's the base case here is the mechanics of the currency do not create.
So let's look at the change in the case with a shared currency not controlled by us, because we'll call it us, even though I'm not anywhere close to the money printer, right? I've got nothing to do with the Fed, but I'm
American. You're talking about the dollar?
Right. So moving away from an American-controlled currency, a human-controlled. Right. Let's say we've got an AI bot-controlled, perfectly fair system. Is that are we the rich kids now at this point, where we're all going to suffer as the spoiled rich kids, watching everyone else fighting hard in ways that they didn't get to fight before?
Well, okay. So again, you're bringing up these hypothetical scenarios that I can't really speak to, because we've got a lot of factors in there that I can't track, I can't weigh. And, you know, I can come up with these sort of imaginary worlds, but they're just imaginary worlds. I can tell you where I think the real world is going, and that's kind of what we wanted to do here.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what I think is happening is, actually, let's talk about fiat versus Bitcoin just for another second here. Because what we have is this thing where the U.S. dollar is becoming more and more unmoored from its base value, which was the gold standard. And then it sort of turned into this energy thing. And they tried to keep the expansion of the amount of currency in the system down to a level that was manageable, to like 2% a year, whatever, to match gold. But that's kind of coming loose, and it's really not the way it used to be. And we see these sort of rubber band effects where the effects of the dislocation from a real basis in something that humans can't manipulate is just getting worse and worse. Okay, that's what we see with the dollar right now. And that's just undeniable. We've got this debt spiral going on where they're going to be forced to start printing money to pay the debts, and it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. Mathematically, there's no way out of that. Politically, there's no way out of that. If you could actually reduce the spending enough to start saving money, you could maybe change that. That's called austerity. If you could, either way, point is, I don't see a realistic way to change that dynamic. So then we've got this other question: what happens when the U.S. dollar loses confidence? Because, as we say, money is a confidence game. People have confidence in the thing they want to use to pay for whatever it is they're wanting in terms of real value, whether it's shells or gold.
I'll put this out there. There's more than one kind of confidence. You can have the confidence that it's worth something, and you can have the confidence that if you try to use something else, they'll come kill you. And we don't want to get there. But it's there.
No, that's absolutely true. But the point is, at base, what you're dealing with on a human level, whether it's a black market situation or a white market situation or anything else, is the confidence that that other guy over there wants what you've got. Absolutely. Whether it's barter or currency or anything else, it's a confidence game. And over time, we tend to move from barter to currency as human beings. That's just a fact. So then the question is, what is likely to replace the US dollar if it goes belly up? Because it's headed that way, right? It's slowly degenerating, and the speed of degeneration is increasing. So over the next 10, 20 years, what do we think we will likely see? Because this is not a straight line in degeneration. It's a curve. It's a hockey stick graph. Once it starts to degenerate, it goes faster and faster and faster and faster until it just totally loses confidence. And, sure. You know, you'll get little blips in it. You get strange patterns, but they follow these mathematical laws of the universe. It's kind of strange even. It's like the Fibonacci spiral determining network effect growth. It's a very strange dynamic, but that is what happens. So the question then is, what is likely to take the place of the US dollar? If we didn't have the US dollar degenerating, there really wouldn't be a void for Bitcoin to fill. People have this thing where they like to use the same thing they've always used. They don't like to stop. So if it still works, they're going to keep doing it. They won't want to move to something new.
Sure.
Unless it has really obvious benefits, they don't want to do it.
I want to say that probably moved, as far as the most intelligent of us, moved away from cash into stocks and non-cash asset storage for a good long time now.
Sure, in terms of store of value, but in terms of a medium of exchange, until you get to a point where money is halving in value over the course of 24 hours, like they had in the Weimar Republic, it gets harder to get to make medium of exchange not worth using, because people are just used to using it, right? So,
well, and how would you notice these days with credit cards versus wheelbarrows? It would be difficult to tell.
Right, it would. But the point is still that as the US dollar degenerates and people lose confidence in it, is there something else that can come up to take its place? And there are basically only two options. One is gold, the other is Bitcoin. Any other option that is theoretical right now, like people talk about the Russia and its allies creating this basket of commodities currency that's based on, you know, the BRICS countries creating this currency based on a basket of commodities. There are too many incentives inside that power block for them to screw each other over for that to work on a long-term basis. You could have something that would go for a few years, but you look at what's going on with the euro lately. I mean, it has lasted a while, but that's all based on an increasing centralization of political power into Brussels. And even then, it's showing some cracks. Brexit happened. There are other countries that are, and they're seeing worse inflation than we are. So really what you're looking at at base is a situation where all of the fiat currencies in the world are like melting ice cubes, and Bitcoin is getting firmer and firmer. It's actually getting less and less inflation. So the incentive for people is to actually start using it. And we've actually seen that start to happen. If you look at US companies, at how many of them hold Bitcoin as a treasury reserve asset, over the past 3 years, that number has gone from zero to in the dozens, and it's continuing to increase exponentially more and more. Different countries are doing this too. So El Salvador buys one Bitcoin every day with their fiat. They buy one Bitcoin every single day. And we're seeing more and more of this sort of thing where as one person starts to use it and another person starts to use it, it incentivizes everybody else around them to get in on it. And that is just getting more and more and more true. Okay, so Bitcoin is a monetary black hole. It's sucking people in. As the fiat currencies melt, Bitcoin is just getting more solid. Okay. And that's where we're at today.
I see that as well. I see comments on the sign up sheet to buy into that specific
right asset. And so where we're going from here is, you know, making predictions about the future is always really hard, because unless you have some kind of prophetic gift, which in this case I am not claiming that this is a prophetic gift, I just see patterns, right? That autistic part of my brain that sees things in a certain way sees this particular pattern so clearly that it's impossible for me to unsee it. And so what I'm actually seeing is that we've got this situation where a currency is getting ready to upset the primary world currency, which is the dollar. And all of the political alliances and power blocks that currently exist, exist in relationship to the dollar right now, because they have to.
It's something even more than that, though, because if you were to take something like a Chinese person that was trading in U.S. treasuries and things for the whole of reasons that China would get into dollars, the average Chinese person still has non-dollars that they're going to the store with. This is different in that everybody around the world might be on the same currency, in which case those countries that have an extra billion people have an advantage for selling cheap tchotchkes to everybody for 50 cents or the equivalent of shidoshi, right? Sure. So you're popular. Those sort of things start to matter in a...
Well, that was, that again, that was the case under the gold standard. You're right. So again, what we're doing really is we're projecting the idea of a sort of a an accelerated and intensified gold standard out into the future, where if people are adopting Bitcoin, which I think they are, then we see Bitcoin become adopted as a world currency over the next decade or two. And at the end of that time, you're looking at a situation where exactly what you say is true, but we can actually see what economics is going to look like there because we can project the gold standard forward. What we can't do is we can't say that the gold standard is exactly like what Bitcoin is going to be in two particulars. One is that Bitcoin has no built-in inflation rate. We're not discovering more Bitcoin, or actually we are, but it's decreasing instead of something that's variable. The halving happened this year. That's half the amount of new Bitcoin being created in mining blocks. And it's going to happen again in four more years. So we're actually having the amount of new Bitcoin being created every 4 years. And right now we are under 2%. We're at like 1.4% internal inflation rate on Bitcoin. That's how much it's actually expanding. Okay. So that's one thing that's different, and that's going to just intensify the desire for people to own it while it's still a solid currency, because the effect of this whole black hole that sucks people in because of the relative advantage of owning it is super strong because of that. Okay, then the other thing that we've got that's different is that Bitcoin is not a physical good that is whose fidelity is determined by the creator when he made the world, right? Where gold, we got so much of it that we can dig up and no more, and its fidelity was created by God. Bitcoin's is determined by the software. And so this is where I like to bring the U.S. Constitution into things, because one moment. I feel like I'm dying here, man. Yeah. Anyhow. Okay. So the U.S. Constitution is essentially at base something similar to Bitcoin, because the U.S. Constitution relied on hostile forces that were opposed to each other, different states and the different people in the country, to maintain a balance that was laid out by a protocol. That's what the U.S. Constitution is at base. Bitcoin is exactly the same thing. It is a monetary protocol that relies on hostile parties to be hostile to each other so that their mutual lack of self-interest, their opposing interests, make it so that it is in nobody's interest to change the rules to favor a group. And basically at that point, Bitcoin is in some way democratic. And so as soon as everyone is using it and the power blocks in the world start reforming around it, then the way it's used can be changed in the same way that the U.S. Constitution's use has been changed. It still reads the same way it did a couple hundred years ago, almost. There have been a few amendments, but it's similar, right? But the way it's implemented has changed so dramatically to the point where we ignore several of the clauses, like the one that limits everything the federal government can do to what's actually enumerated in the Constitution and leaves the rest to the states is totally ignored nowadays. It has no weight. And it's because we don't follow the Constitution anymore. And it's because a particular power block was able to form in such a way as to basically pull the pull the support out from under the Constitution. It wasn't a set of opposing forces anymore. Enough of them got together to change the power dynamic and to change the way it was used. And it is inevitable that that will happen with Bitcoin as well. There is no question. There is no doubt. It's like saying that Bitcoin is taking over the world currency. In my mind, I can't see a way around that. I can't see a way that that doesn't happen. I also can't see a way that it won't eventually be appropriated by a large enough power block for its use in some fashion, as the U.S. Constitution was. And it's a great analogy because the U.S. Constitution wasn't changed. The rules never changed. They just started ignoring them. And in Bitcoin, you can do what you call soft forks, which means you can start to use new rules that don't contradict the old rules. They just let you do new things with the software, and people are mostly okay with it. So a smaller than 70% group can change the rules in meaningful ways. You just can't contradict anything that came before. So if you're smart, if you're clever, you can change things in a way that favors you without actually breaking the system. And in my mind, that is inevitably going to happen. We're not there yet because the power system hasn't reformed around Bitcoin yet.
It's interesting. A couple of things that I see that are different now than any time before is, if before you were on a gold standard and you wanted to say that a weight of grain was cheaper somewhere else and more expensive in a different place, they had very little way to communicate the price of things, peasant to peasant across Africa to England. Whereas now, instantaneously, everybody's comparing the price of a loaf of bread everywhere in the world, especially once you get to a same currency,
right?
It really gets to be...
So price discovery basically... price discovery propagates or travels much faster than it used to. That doesn't, again, change the rules of the currency or affect the rules of the currency, but you're right that the price discovery is much quicker across the world than it used to be, no question.
Well, and price discovery, not just with the cost of goods, but the quality of life, we'll just call it that, your overall quality of life. For the first time, really for the first time, we've started getting cell phones in the hands of every child on the whole planet. And for the first time in history, people realized that they could have it better if they just left where they were at. This is a new revelation to humankind. With the combined additive, like, evener of the same currency, right? It's kind of like if you were to take that concept of the Constitution and you were to pair it out to 50 states, now you've got 50 states using that constitution how they like, and we advertise California for 30 years while ignoring the rest of the country, irregardless of successes in the rest of the country, and you get pushes right that way. Where
sure, it's gonna have all kinds of interesting dynamics in how people respond to it, no question. Very interesting stuff.
And countries using media to try to push the currency in a way that's beneficial for that country. And I see a lot of odd interaction under a similar same currency with differences of governments. They're essentially competing for minds and bodies, and right, they're no longer guaranteed their populace. And that is a change with the global Bitcoin, global communication. Right.
Sure. I mean, it's causing all sorts of things. And if you want to talk about the outworkings of what Bitcoin could cause or is causing, that's a heck of a that's a longer conversation, and it's a heck of a thing.
Yeah, that's the biggest changes to our daily lives, I think, will be in that, in the way that people interact on that level. Do you think
and I can totally see that.
Do you think that we'll end up with some sort of national currencies in different places, and Bitcoin is what people try to save in?
You know, there is this thing called Fediments that allows you to use Bitcoin as your reserve asset for the group of people who are using this Fediment, and then the whole mint together has a currency that they can use that is, they exchange back and forth, that's based on the Bitcoin that the mint is holding. And that's an interesting system. So I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. The only things that I can see that that I see as being inevitable are, number one, Bitcoin is going to be the world reserve currency, probably within a couple of decades. And number two, that it's going to be co-opted once it is the world reserve currency and there's no way around it. And the way it's co-opted is an interesting question because what?
You don't see any possibility for artificial agent to be in charge of it because everyone trusts that no one can be trustworthy?
And that's I see all sorts of opportunity for an artificial agent to be in charge of it. I still think that artificial agent in the world we live in, with powers and principalities and spiritual forces that are working against us, is a power block in and of its own right. That there is no such thing as a neutral referee short of God himself. And that right now Bitcoin is not.
The problem with that concept is that you would think that God would be a neutral referee, but he forgives way more than he should. I mean, the computer would just kill you.
Well, okay, so that's a whole other conversation. But my point is that we can trust that those powers and principalities are not a neutral referee, and that they do not have our best interests at heart, that they're here to kill, steal, and destroy. I mean, we know that. So, yeah.
I certainly feel anything? Like the point that I was one of the biggest fears I have is humanity throwing their hands up saying we can't handle it, right?
Yeah.
It's beyond us. And then we get ourselves in some kind of worse situation.
Yeah. Well, and this other, you know, that's sort of what I'm seeing here is that in the end, what we're going to have is that the powers and principalities that are in control of everything, once you get the situation going on, like with the U.S. Constitution, where one power block owns everything, the rulers of this world then control that thing. And when it's one currency across the whole world, the network effect of that currency is so powerful that escaping it is next thing to impossible.
It is a convoluted, complex system to interact with, but I think that I would end on it's important to interact with it because it, part of its system is your voting power, is your cooperation in it. And if you don't have any cooperation in it, you have no voting power.
Well, and what I would end on is this, that right now we have a problem. A fiat monster is eating the world, and Bitcoin is the only way I see to get out of that. And so we've got a solution to this problem that, as with all human solutions, is going to turn into another problem down the road, almost certainly. And so what? We've got a problem we have to solve right now, and just bellyaching about the fact that there are no perfect solutions available to us doesn't fix the problem we have right now. We have to use the solution that we have available right now. That's Bitcoin. Go buy Bitcoin, defeat the fiat monster, and then we can talk about the next thing. And you know what? Before all of that, trust in Jesus Christ with all your heart and mind, because he is the solution, and no human solution is going to bring a solution, and that's the bottom line. That's what I would leave people with.
Agreed.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.